Welcome to Books, where two guys tell you about the books they're reading. I'm Rob Olson.
And I'm Livia Snedden. We have quite the action-packed episode for you this evening. We're going to kick it off with what I believe now, if not before, is the most reviewed author on this show.
He's got to be at this point. It's at least four books.
Yeah, so we are going to review The Elvis Room, the forthcoming chapbook from our friends at This Is Horror. Then, as if that's not enough excitement for the night, we're going to bring on Stephen Graham Jones, and we're going to grill him about The Elvis Room, amongst other, you know, the 24 other books he's got coming out this year. And then, carry over from last episode, we are going to talk about Pablo de Stair's film, which should be interesting. So, but we're going to kick it off first with a little bit about Stephen Graham Jones, just in case you've never heard the show. Born and raised in Texas, in Boulder, Colorado now, 42, Blackfeet, into werewolves and slashers and zombies. Would wear pirate shirts a lot if I could find them, and probably carry some kind of sword. He would wear pirate shirts. I would also wear pirate shirts. I just won't admit it.
I thought that was some sort of, yeah, like last minute admission about your love of pirate shirts.
Dude, how cool would I look at a pirate shirt? Come on.
Man, I just imagine you and Jones both hanging out in pirate shirts.
There you go. Yeah. I'm not the one who got to hang out with him, though, or there definitely would have been some pirate shirting going on.
Yeah, there was just pasties.
See, Jones could have been hanging out with me, pirate shirts, with you, pasties. This is the way of the world.
Well, that's how you got to sell it to him. Be like, come out to Chicago. No more pasties. It's going to be all pirate shirts.
There you go. Maybe we'll ask him about pasties. See if he liked it enough to carry it on into his everyday life.
All right. Well, until we get to him, I'm just going to tell everybody a little bit about The Elvis Room. This is the synopsis pulled from the This Is Horror website. What if you weren't looking for evidence of the supernatural, but found it all the same? A true research scientist can either hide that evidence or tell the world. Either way, it's going to haunt you. Either way, your life is never going to be the same. Find out what's always on the other side of the door. It's The Elvis Room.
All right, so I'll tell you up front. We can't talk a whole lot about this, which is really unfortunate. And that's the problem, because, you know what? I'm loving these chapbooks from This Is Horror. Mm-hmm. We can never talk about them because we out-talk the length of the novella. I don't remember. Do you remember offhand this one, 40-ish pages?
Yeah, something like that. It was a quick read.
Very quick read. But what we have is a scientist who, through the course of his other research, kind of uncovers a ghost, right? I mean, that's pretty much it.
He kind of accidentally approves the existence of ghosts.
Right. And is kind of laughed into obscurity, but decides that he has a way where he could set up a scientific study. I'm questioning a little bit how scientific it all was, but surrounding ghosts in hotels to prove his theory and regain his, you know, his once great status.
The whole idea is when in his original studies before he was became more or less a laughing stock, he was working toward that, you know, world altering discovery. He thought he had on the horizon, and then the ghost thing kind of destroyed that. And in the following years, he was basically trying to, it didn't seem like he was too bent on redeeming himself until he had this kind of like epiphany about something. And then it was kind of an all consuming, pursuit after that.
Indeed. What I find most interesting about this is a guy like Stephen Graham Jones, for anybody who's heard interviews with him or reads his website or a lot of his other stories, is his touching on this little bit of, noetic science, that I'm also going to grill him on, because I want more Stephen Graham Jones meets noetic science. Rob, are you familiar with noetic science?
I think so. Is that like that TV show Fringe?
Yeah, it's a little bit like Fringe. I mean, the whole thing came to light for me and probably lots of other, at least mainstream readers, from the Dan Brown book, The Inferno. No, Inferno is the one we reviewed, the one before Inferno. I'm not going to bother looking that up.
Something about a symbol? Last symbol, yeah. Or lost symbol?
Yeah, the last symbol. Yeah, the lost symbol. That's the one. Basically, it's a study that was founded by the institute that spearheads this was founded by Edgar Mitchell, who was a part of the Apollo 14 space shuttle mission. And basically what they do is they do things like they try to find out if there's a human soul by like weighing bodies right as they're dying to see if there's a change in weight, or, you know, studying, I don't know, almost like wish theory. Like they you can go on their website, you can sign up for a thing where like on Thursday, you know, you will sit in front of your computer and just wish, like, you know, they'll give you an image and you'll wish things to like move a little to the left. And if they have enough people, they think it can happen, like that kind of stuff. So kind of like Fringe. I mean, they almost touch on religion and ESP and, you know, a bunch of other things, but they're trying to prove it all scientifically as opposed to, you know, what we're, you know, ghost hunters on TV.
Oh, noetic science. That is the interesting part about this book, though, is because it is a scientist approaching traditionally non-scientific things, just the whole, the technical approach to it, the very clinical look at shit that, like, you know, is like little kids giggle about and tell, you know, stories about over, you know, at a campfire and stuff. So it really is kind of, to me at least, the very compelling part of the story, the interesting part that makes you want to keep reading.
Before we started recording, Robert told me that after reading this, he didn't want to ever check into another hotel again, which I don't know that I'm going to go quite that far, but after our previous hotel experience.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah, back in Corydon, Indiana, Stephen Graham Jones may have scientifically proven that our hotel was haunted.
That's right, with the sign that changed and the moving objects in the hotel room.
Yep. Maybe. Yeah, there's lots of creepy things going on there.
Maybe it wasn't you snoring that loud. Maybe it was a ghost.
I am going to support this statement 100%. But no, I think that the story itself really lended itself to a very, very creepy vibe. And I will say this. I'm not sure how this is horror, and I'm assuming more specifically Michael Wilson. Like what kind of pool he has to pull from these things, or what the submission process is. But I got to tell you, there was chalk and there was this, and both of them were just goddamn creepy as hell.
Yeah, I dug it.
Yeah, you know, chalk wasn't like a traditional horror story, but there were just some really, really creepy parts in that. And I think that this being, you know, what I look for in a more classical horror story, just scary as hell.
Yeah. The there was descriptions of certain things that appear. His descriptions of stuff and like the use of like empty space is incredibly creepy. He really did all, like, he hit on all the classic horror, very visual elements of like classic horror, like film and stuff. He hit on very well in the story that those were the stuff that really, like, you know, made your hair stand up and stuff.
All right, so the chapbook is sold out. So if you want a physical copy, you are SOL. But you will be able to pick up the ebook version here in another week. The March 31st, I think, is the release date.
I agree with that.
Yeah, and here's the thing. Before we go on to kind of summate this book and give it a rating, I'm going to make a very public plea to Michael Wilson. Michael, you got to get someone in the U.S. to distribute your chapbooks. That's it. That's all I'm saying. Should I elaborate?
Sure, go ahead. I don't know. I like shipping, the idea of having like the Royal Mail.
Shipping is murder on the chapbook. So I think that Mr. Wilson could expand his chapbook sales simply by having someone distribute them here in the U.S. I'm going to volunteer Rob do it.
Oh man, he's going to take you up on that, and then I'm just going to have a pile of chapbooks in my. Yeah, that doesn't sound so bad. Maybe I'll do it.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. So yeah, here's what he needs to do: put 300 of them or whatever in a box. Pay one time to ship them to Rob. Still ding people for the shipping, but it would cost less something in as one package versus multiple small packages, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you ship them out to people or somebody.
Yeah.
I know other people I could volunteer, but you just happen to be the one that is sitting back in horror right now at the fact that I just did it. So.
Yeah, I thought that Jones's story was horrifying.
Yeah. Like, we could pass it off to Jesse Lawrence, too.
That's true. Maybe A. Adam Otten.
Yeah, there you go. There's some names for you, Mr. Wilson. So there you go. That's my two cents on the whole chapbook thing. All right, Rob, you want to wrap this up?
Yeah. So I know we've been talking about Jones a lot lately. He's just a really solid writer in general, and I especially love when he goes pretty headlong into horror. Having recently read The Least of My Scars, I was worried that there wouldn't be much that could, you know, approach that level of awesomeness. And, you know, it's just because I love that book so much, you put things on a pedestal. In reality, Jones is just a good writer, and pretty much everything you read is at that level of excellence. This story is no exception. It's incredibly creepy. It actually manages to cram in some heartfelt moments, some humor, and touches on the really interesting stuff with, like Livius was saying, the more hints of noetic science, if you will. So all in all, loved it. And as I've loved pretty much all of the This Is Horror Chat books, I'm going to do 5 stars.
Yeah, not much to say that Rob hasn't already said. You know, Stephen Graham Jones meets noetic science. I mean, I think that's all anybody needs to know about this. Buy the ebook and read it. It's easily a 5-star read. Goddamn creepy, too. That's all I got. Yeah. All right, so everybody was like, oh, these guys are talking about a book again. All right. Here's the main event for the evening. Momentarily, we're going to be bringing on Stephen Graham Jones. Dude, do we have any really controversial or, like, confrontational questions to start off with?
Why didn't you give us a story for the booked anthology?
Yeah, we could do that. That we could do. That's really the only one. I'm sure that's on both of our minds. I don't know if we'll actually ask him. So, Stephen, thanks for coming back on again. It's been quite a while.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So we earlier in the episode did a quick review of your chapbook, The Elvis Room, that's published through This Is Horror. And anytime we do a review of an author's work and then have them on, we like to give them the opportunity to kind of, you know, talk about it in their own words. So do you have a quick rundown of what The Elvis Room is all about?
Oh, it's about a scientist type who accidentally discovers ghosts, maybe. And it adversely affects his career, and he goes into a professional tailspin, and it gets to the point where the only way he can get out of that tailspin is to go deeper into the ghost world.
I was a little surprised because, you know, based on the title, I was actually expecting an appearance from Elvis and not one in the whole damn book.
Oh, that's a spoiler.
Yeah. So, yeah, I guess that is it's a non-spoiler. I'm going to tell you what's not in this book. There's zero Elvis in this book. So.
Yeah, you need more than, 13,000 words to get Elvis in a story, I think, man.
So I personally think that noetic science is just so goddamn interesting. Is that a personal topic of interest for you?
You know, I'm always reading science. I've been a long-time subscriber to Discover magazine, I guess, and I pick up a lot of the other science magazines as well. And a lot of the I guess you'd call it non-professional reading, whatever, that I do is science, largely anthropology and brain science. I just, science really appeals to me a lot. If only I ever could have mastered anything close to math, I could have gone that direction, I think.
Are you planning any longer works on the, I don't know, kind of fringe type science that was in this book?
I don't have any planned right now. I've got a longer work planned that deals with hominid evolution, but I worry that I'm just going to use the characters as kind of a springboard to spout theories, you know, and I need to actually tell a story. I can't just talk science. That's always the problem with me when I start talking about science stuff, is that I can do that for pages and then I realize, hey, I need to move the story also, you know, so it's a trick, definitely.
One of the things I liked was that about the story was kind of, in a way, it's just these, it hinges in a way in certain times on mundane observations of things, just like when you have enough of a certain instance that exists, suddenly you realize this is something that could be more than just something that randomly happens. And I think my mind works like that a lot. But it made me think, I mean, I don't know how much time you spend in hotels, but was this one of those kind of spawned from thinking about this type of thing when you've been traveling and stuff, or?
Oh, definitely. Yes. I spend so much time on the road and so much time in hotels, and that's exactly where it comes from. You know, sometimes I'll be walking to my room on the 5th floor and it'll be 2 in the morning and I look back and I'll see somebody walking, you know, 15 rooms behind me or something, and I'll turn back around and start casing through numbers of my doors, and then when I next time I look back, that person's gone, and I don't have any proof that they went into a door. You know, they might have just blipped out of existence or gone ahead of me somehow or gone to the other floor. And yeah, I get scared a lot in hotels, I guess that is what I'm saying.
I think you just scared me even more in the story. Damn it.
We were talking briefly. There was this, we went to a reading in Southern Indiana one time, and we were staying in a hotel really close to where the event was. And when we first checked in, I'll tell it really briefly because I know our listeners have heard this before. We first checked in, we went up the elevator. It was like the second floor or the third or whatever. Got out and went the wrong way because the sign was had the numbers for what numbers were to the left and to the right. Is that how it went? We went the wrong way, Olivius?
Yeah, the sign pointed one way. We went that way and saw that their sign was wrong. So yeah, we turned around. So their sign was actually pointing that way. So we go back the other way. We get to our room. We get settled in. We come back from the event, walk up, you know, the elevator door opens. We see the sign. We purposely walk in the wrong direction. And the sign was no longer the same.
Oh, yeah. Wow. That's like a trap, man.
Yeah.
That's
scary. Yeah.
It was, I gotta tell you, it was goddamn creepy.
Yeah. So. You know, I stayed in a place, I don't know, it's probably been 3 or 4 months. I put a little video online somewhere of it. It was a old hotel. Like, you know, it was like a lot older than Civil War. And I was staying in this room. And well, at first, you know, at the check-in desk, there's all these flyers and pamphlets about ghosts because this place is supposed to be all haunted. So I was already scared, you know. And then I go up to my room, which is kind of in a, you know, a side building from the main hotel. And just, you know, checking out the room, flicking lights on, seeing what's what. And then I chance to look above me, and there's a big, like, oblong square. It's a big rectangle. Like, it looks like an attic, you know, but it's just a hole. It's got molding around it, and of course I'm freaked out by that, you know. And no way am I going to sleep without looking up there. And so I rig up some sort of chair system, and I'm able to jump up there and grab on and pull myself up. And right above me is a totally finished out little room, like for kids. It's only tall enough for, like, you know, 5-year-olds to be in. And there's no furniture, and the closet door is open. And it was really terrifying. I was up for most of that night, man.
Oh. Damn it. I think Rob's right. I'm going to start sleeping in my car when I go somewhere.
Yeah,
I'm not staying in hotels anymore. No hostels. I don't know. I'm just going to sleep in like bookstore couches or something.
Yeah.
Can we talk a little bit about genre? So we talked to you 2.5 years ago, and I listened to this episode earlier today, so it really struck me as kind of timely based on some other conversations we've recently had. But you said something along the lines of that Lansdale, when talking about genre, said he writes in the Lansdale genre. Does that sound familiar?
Mm-hmm.
And
it does, yeah.
I've had conversations with more than one person about how you personally don't really it's tough to genre-fy you in a way because you have a diversity of things you write. And actually, we were talking to Jeff Vandermeer when we interviewed him, and we talked to him about writing sci-fi versus mainstream because his current book is getting a lot of mainstream attention, but it's got a sci-fi element to it. And his thought was he doesn't really think in terms of genre as far as his writing goes, so getting down to the question, how important do you think it is to really classify writing by genre? Is it something that you really care about, or do you just write what the story becomes?
You know, I guess, I mean, I can say yes to both of them, really, because what I'm doing every time I sit down to write is I want to write a story or a novel that I would like to read. But the trick is I read all across the shelf. You know, it'll be science fiction one day, young adult the next, horror, literary, innovative, just all across the board. Which is to say, since I like to read everything, I like to write everything. But genrefication, or whatever you want to call it, is important because the publishers, well, the agents need to be able to market your book to the publishers. And then if the publisher accepts it, they need to be able to market it to the audience. So, yeah, if you can say this is, you know, techie sci-fi or something, and that's going to plug into an audience who is going to buy it pretty much without reading the back cover copy. They're going to say, hey, I like hard sci-fi. I like this, you know? And, you know, it's also important if, like, when I'm writing a slasher, I really need to stay in touch the whole time with the whole body of slashers out there. So I need to be completely cued into all the conventions, not necessarily so I can repeat them, but so I can either steer around them or undercut them or amplify them or something. So I can't say either or to answer that question, I don't think, because I kind of see both sides.
Yeah, it's something that I think we bump into more and more as the podcast continues, is from the perspective of a reader, it's a nice, easy way to find stuff to, as an audience member, it's an easy way to know at a glance whether this might interest you. But sometimes I think, and this could just be me being oversaturated with reading things, but I almost feel sometimes like a writer is just throwing out genre names for other writers.
Let me think of specific case of that.
And I guess looking deeper at that, I think of the submission process where you have to kind of determine, they have to determine whether what you're writing is fitting for what they need.
So,
I don't know, like the whole psychology of deciding what genre your story is just something that's been fascinating for me lately.
Yeah, also, lots of the times you can, like, there's this magazine, Five Trope, online. It's, I think, a subpart of Web Del Sol or something. I've got a story there called Exodus, which is a story written in 21 little blocks, 21, like, bullet points, kind of, and they're all numbered. And I wrote that story specifically because I was reading their submission guidelines, and they said, you know, we don't want this, that, or the other, just the usual stuff. And then they had this weird addendum, we don't want any flashcard story. And I stopped and I thought, man, what the heck is flashcard story, a flashcard fiction or flashcard stories? And so I sat down that afternoon and I wrote what I imagine a flashcard fiction would look like, which is just lists and, you know, blocky stuff. And I wrote it and I thought, well, I should send it to them first because I wrote it for them. I mean, I wrote it because of them, not for them. And it's specifically what they didn't want, but I sent it to them and they immediately accepted it, you know?
So much for guidelines.
So, I mean, which is to say, lots of times with a magazine, if they're saying we don't want X, Y, and Z, what that means really is they're not seeing X, Y, and Z, such that if you can slip something that's Y-ish in there, then that might pique their interest, you know?
Oh, and that's interesting.
So, one of our favorite parts of our previous interview, because apparently we live in the past quite a bit, if you didn't notice, I'm starting to notice. So you had given us a 3-minute history on zombies. You recently posted a 10-minute version on YouTube.
Yeah.
We want to know is, can you do it for werewolves? We've been talking a lot about werewolves lately.
I have. You know, I plan on getting that together. Yeah. Right now, it's all kind of swirling around in my head. I've been reading so much werewolf stuff, and I just wrote a werewolf novel, and so I can't do it in 3 minutes at this point. I don't think. I mean, it seems like there was a huge sea change in the werewolf when the Wolfman came out. That kind of codified so much stuff. Before that, you had the man becoming the wolf, like he sits behind a light pole and he becomes a wolf, you know. And but you didn't have a lot of wolfmen. And after the Wolfman, it seems like that's largely what we've had, are Wolfmen. You know, I mean, all the way up to, what, Teen Wolf now, I guess. So soon, maybe next time y'all have me on, I'll be able to do that. I don't have it all bullet-pointed in my head properly yet. It's still all kind of loose and jangly.
All right, so how about recommending? You said you've been reading a lot of werewolf stuff. Give us one recommendation. Yeah. If someone wants to read a great werewolf book, what's it going to be?
I like The Howling a lot, you know. The old Gary Bradner, what's it from, like 79 or 80, I guess, came out as a movie in probably 81. It's a really quick read. But there's contemporary stuff too. Benjamin Percy just did Red Moon. Cary Vaughan's got the Kitty in the Midnight Hour series going on. You know, Toby Barlow gave us Sharp Teeth. Glenn Duncan's doing werewolves with The Last Werewolf and Tallulah Rising, I guess. And there's the werewolf anthologies. They really captivate me. There's so much interesting stuff going on in the short story, which is always the way it is. Like with film, that's where you always find the new stuff happening, is in the little 5 and 10 minute short films. But yeah, the werewolf is, I mean, he or she is not going to stay in one codified form. It's always changing.
That's I was in, when I was in Seattle for AWP, I actually was in a bookstore and I caught, I didn't even realize it was out, but the third book in Glenn Duncan's werewolf series must have just hit the shelves. So I have a copy. Nice. And it actually, I read the synopsis of it. It says it's an erotic werewolf thing. So going in that direction.
Do I remember the last... Yeah, the last werewolf had. I mean, that was all the reviews were always talking about the graphic sex scenes. But you know, go back to the Howling. I mean, the Howling movie especially. It's all about turning to a wolf and have sex. And you know, there's always people who argue that that's what the werewolf is. It's kind of, I don't know, visibly charting our adolescence. You know, you've got hair sprouting up. You've got strange urges. You live mostly at night. It fits puberty anyways, and it always leads into sex, it seems like. But yeah, I remember I was in Seattle too, and what's that bookstore, that big, where they had that big party, Elliott Bay.
Yeah,
that's it. I was standing there talking to somebody, and I looked over their head, and there was like 10 of Benjamin Percy's Red Moons over there on the top shelf, and it was neat to look across the room and see werewolves, you know.
Yeah, that's awesome. Shifting gears a little bit, young adult. So you've got the Floating Boy and the Girl Who Couldn't Fly, co-authored by Paul Tremblay. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that was all kinds of fun. That's my first time to ever co-write a novel, and you know, Paul's the ideal person to do it with. He's a good writer and a patient human. You know, he was able to deal with my inability to manage files. You know, I'd always be editing on the wrong file and sending him a totally different file and all that kind of stuff. But he's good to work with, and he's a very careful writer, and he's careful, and I just kind of jump into things and go really fast, you know. So I think we were a good balance or mix or something. But yeah, young adult is where it's at. You know, there's even some good young adult werewolves. There's Justine Larbeleister's Liar. I like that book a lot. There's also, what's it called, Blood and Chocolate, I think it is. Yeah, werewolves are happening everywhere, but Floating Boy and the Girl Who Couldn't Fly is not werewolves at all. And you probably noticed for that we're not Stephen Graham Jones and Paul Tremblay. We are P.T. Jones. I never have been anybody else for a book. It's kind of fun.
What type of considerations do you have to take into account when writing young adult versus just writing for everybody, I guess, which is what you typically do? I mean, how much did you have to kind of really think about tailoring it for a young audience?
That's a good question. I want to say that Paul and I didn't actually tailor it in the writing of it. The editing process really kind of funneled us away from content that would have been pulling bad reviews with the young adult gatekeepers and all that. And we're aware of it too, of course. But it seems like young adult is less about what you can't do and more about plugging in to issues and circumstances that actually impact your target audience, you know? So what we're dealing with is feeling like an outsider and walking the boy across the room but not knowing how to talk to him, and dealing with parents who are kind of crazy, and dealing with strangers and babysitting. I think really if you can tap into that kind of stuff, then young adult is just blown so wide open. There's, as far as content, as far as profanity, as far as sexuality, it's all over the place, and I don't think you can necessarily reel that back in, and I think that's probably good. But what you've got to do is just tap into the things that are vital to your audience, and you've got to do that at all levels, not just young adult, of course, but with young adult you are kind of hyper aware of that, I guess.
Dude, we might have to do like a young adult thing. We got this one's coming out, and John Horner Jacobs has that series he's doing. Yeah. It seems like a lot of the people we know are kind of heading in that direction, and it's kind of interesting. It's kind of exciting to like see just the variety that people we know are writing in is pretty cool.
Yeah, no, I think young adult is such a, I mean, it's been a happening genre for a long time. It's so fun to play in those fields, you know. And I mean, I read a lot of young adult, so it makes sense that I would write some young adult myself, you know. I think the next book I read, well, right after I hopefully get to Adam Cesare's The First One You Expect, I hope to get to the second Divergent book, you know.
Oh, right on. They're doing like movies on those now, right?
Yeah, yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty good movies too. I was impressed.
A future Chicago. I'm a little scared to see what that's going to look like, to be honest, having grown up there. I saw the trailer and I was like, I don't know if I really want to, start thinking about where the city's headed. So
yeah, yeah.
Just this past week, Not For Nothing is available. You want to give us a really quick bit on that?
It's a homicide detective who gets booted out of his town, Midland, Texas, which is, you know, 20 miles from where I grew up, and he has to go back to his hometown, and he doesn't have a job, so he becomes a live-in guard for a storage facility. And people keep thinking that because he used to be a homicide detective, now he's automatically a PI, and so they keep bringing him cases. And the cases, of course, you know how it is with PIs, it's always setting you up and framing you, and nobody's being honest with you, and he has to navigate all that and just try to solve the case, but really just try to live through the case, you know. And it's in second person too, which was really fun. And it's in the place I grew up, Stanton, Texas, which was, I really liked revisiting those streets, that skyline, that limited skyline, you know. It's like nothing over three, maybe nothing over two stories, I'm not sure.
It's going to be my follow-up question about second person, because the synopsis is in second person. I don't know if I've ever read like a longer piece that way.
Man, it was fun to write. I had to, you know, it's not as simple as just replacing he with you or I with you, because second person changes the angle of approach and it changes everything drastically. And it creates this kind of weird subjunctive mood over the whole thing. Like if you do this, then this, that, and the other, you know. And it's a wonderful dynamic, I think. And I really wish more people would play in the second person fields. It's very productive.
Sorry, go ahead, Rob.
I have to admit, when I picked it up at the Zank table at the book fair at AWP, I was flipping through and I saw it was second person, and I was like, I had that instinctual cringe of like, ooh, this is, you know, and I felt bad about it.
Yeah.
But then I had the, oh, it's Jones, it'll be fine.
Yeah, we do have that response. Like, we consider first and third to be legitimate, but the one between them is considered a deviation, you know?
Yeah, like almost
gimmicky.
And
because it's a deviation. Yeah, exactly, exactly. But it has been used for gimmicky stuff, but, you know, so is first and third.
That's true.
I think it can be totally powerful, you know. And I think it especially appeals to people like myself who grew up, who kind of cut their teeth on the choose your own adventures, you know, just inhaled one of those every day, you know.
That was a little bit before Rob's time, I think.
Oh, okay.
Rob, choose your own adventure.
It wasn't like a huge part of my childhood, but I read some.
My first instinct when I read second person is, don't tell me what I'm doing. God damn.
that is the problem. That's why second person tends to be in present tense, because when you cast second person in past tense, which is, you know, logically possible anyways, then that immediately throws up walls in the reader's mind of, I didn't just taste that. I didn't just look over there. You know, if you cast it in second person or in a weird kind of diluted future tense, then it becomes a lot more palatable, I think.
Yeah, it just seems like it would be more of a challenge. But I mean, possibly just because people don't write in it as often, that we're not used to it.
Yeah, well, no, it is definitely more of a challenge, I think, because in third person, if your character's named Gary, you can call him Gary sometimes, you can call him he sometimes. With you, you're kind of stuck with you over and over, such that if you go through and use a pink highlighter and highlight all the yous, it can really stand out from the page. So as a writer, when you're laying down those sentences, you have to learn to vary it in such a way that the you doesn't become too monotonous.
I'm goddamn intrigued now. now it's definitely going on my reading.
Cool.
All right, I have a question for you. I was unable to attend Seattle, but I did see the 4,000 pictures from AWP, and there were pictures of you wearing pasties.
Oh yeah, well I was at a Prince themed reading, and my friend Jesse, y'all know Jesse, he won one of the trivia questions because he knows everything about Prince, and I lost a trivia question, and I really did not like losing, so I could feel like I won if I got Jesse to give me some of his prize, and what he got was some silver star pasties or something, you know, and so I stuck them on and then told the crowd when I got up in front of them that I was wearing them, and they asked for proof, you know, and you can't make a claim like that and then be coy, you know.
So have you, is pasties now a thing for you, that experience and you know, open up a whole new world of
a new life of
underwear, I guess, right? Underwear? Yeah. It'd be underwear.
Yeah.
Unless you're not wearing it over. Yeah.
I guess it would be. No, I did find that they're really a conversation starter, but I think if you come to depend on them to start all your conversations, and all your conversations are probably going to go a certain way, you know, so it's probably safest to learn other ways to talk to people.
I just I thought it was great timing because you posted that piece about your celebrating the 20th book.
Yeah.
And one of your advice to writers is never let people take pictures of you with your shirt off.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking, because those pictures were starting to show up on Facebook, and that's why I thought of that.
So I guess sometimes it's important to not take your own advice.
Exactly. Yeah, you live and learn.
In the good old days, it was that one guy that had the Polaroid. You just had to keep it quiet. Now,
exactly.
No, yeah,
it's everywhere.
Yeah, man.
So, is there anything else you want to talk about a little bit before we say goodnight? You got a plug or anything?
Plug. Let me see. I've got after the people lights go off, after the people lights have gone off, it's coming up from Dark House in October. And I think we've already got, I think Larry Barron's blurred it already. And Richard Thomas told me that Joe Lansdale has got an introduction turned in. And I'm sure there will be more people blurbing it, you know, as we get closer to publication. I like it a lot as far as a horror collection, or as far as just a book. But I just hope it scares people. You know, it scares me every time I look at those stories. As far as plugs go, I'm in the process of signing a contract or getting the contract done for Once Upon a Time in Texas, which is the second Bunnyhead Chronicles book, which is due to come out in fall as well, if the contract goes through.
That's awesome.
Gonna be a busy year.
Yeah, it is. But you know, it's like this year and like 2 or 3 years before it have been really busy for me. I've just been like juggling proofs, trying to find time to write something new, because all I'm doing is correcting old stuff. But I mean, I have found time, of course, but in 2015, I may try to make that a bookless year for me, just because I think it's good to slow down sometimes as well. I mean, it's not that I have like, what, 3 or 4 manuscripts right now ready to go, but I'm interested in going slow a little bit and seeing how that feels.
Rob, did you hear the collective groan of the literary community when he said that?
I thought it was a sigh because everybody gets to catch up on everything. Which it's funny because I did listen to that interview we did with you, and at the time you're naming off titles of things that were, you know, coming up in the next couple of years, and it's Not For Nothing and Flush Boy and Least of My Scars got mentioned, and I'm like, these are all the books that just happened to me. So it was cool going back, like, oh, he wasn't a liar. He was actually telling us stuff that was going to happen.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Well, Stephen, we want to thank you so much for taking time to come on and talk to us again. I always love having you on. So thanks.
Thank you. Thanks, man. It was a ball. I always love talking to you.
All right. So again, apologies to anybody who was waiting last week to hear us discuss A Public Ransom. We ran out of time, but we're here to do it this evening. So I'm going to go ahead and read the synopsis. Stephen is a self-serving, amoral author of very mediocre talent. Sounds a little like Caleb Ross. Do you think it was Caleb Ross he was talking about?
Probably based on him.
Yeah. When he stumbles across a crayon-scribbled missing child poster with a scrawled telephone number and the words "Help Me" written on it, he figures it to be harmless, and deciding to base a story around it, he calls the number. This leads to an encounter with Bryant, who flatly claims to have actually kidnapped a girl, stating she will be released only if Stephen pays a mere $2,000 ransom within 2 weeks. Stephen initially dismisses Bryant as a morbid prankster until Bryant begins a relationship with his only friend, Renee, and starts popping up in his life in apparently coincidental, yet increasingly invasive and unsettling ways.
Yeah, I don't think we need to add anything to that.
No, I think that's goddamn, this guy should write synopses for books. That's pretty good.
Some notes on the movie itself. So, it's definitely filmed in a very specific style. So, all the scenes are like single shots. There's really no moving camera angles or anything like that. It's just all one still shot for the whole scene. And, there's a lot of, is it in black and white the whole time?
It is.
All right. Yeah. It's black and white. And lots of the protagonist, the main character, walking and smoking and talking on a phone. And it was all very stylistically intentional. But it's definitely a very strong style that comes across in the way that it was filmed and edited.
Absolutely. I mean, the cast is very small. There are three people. I'm going to give you the names here. Carlisle Edwards, who plays Stephen, also better known to most of us as Pablo D'Astaire. Helen Bonaparte, Sarah D'Astaire. And then Bryant is played by Goodloe Byron. No idea. I don't know who that guy is. But yeah, it's just the three people. So it's a very, very kind of personal film. I mean, there's not a lot of, you know, everything you see is a very personal moment because it's one person or two people. As a matter of fact, I don't think is there any point where they're all three of them are in the scene?
No.
So yeah, it's very, very intimate and personal, or at least it feels that way. And some of it, look, we've reviewed some stuff by Pablo D'Astaire. He's a very, very solid writer, but all of his stories are a little off center, a little weird.
Yeah.
You say that? Yeah, does that seem like a fair and accurate assessment? And this is no different, as you may have been able to tell from the synopsis. That being said, it's very, very well written. I mean, I really like the concept, and I think that the actual writing was very, very solid in here.
Yeah, and really, like, the thing I like about the story is just such a goddamn interesting idea where a guy, first of all, you have this very unlikely poster that he sees, and then the even more unlikely act of him calling it for the sake of fueling his idea for stories is a great idea. And then when he's faced with the potential reality that the kidnapping actually happened, what he thinks is a very mundane decision ends up being such a significant kind of crossroads. So it was a really cool setup for a story that I was really interested in kind of carrying through to the end and seeing what happened.
Yeah, the most interesting part, in my opinion, is the whole, like, yeah, I won't kill her. It's going to be $2,000, you know, because it makes it very accessible.
Right.
You know, versus try to raise $100,000 or whatever. So here's this guy struggling with, you know, just a piddly $2,000 and what he should do and how this affects the rest of his life. I also thought that his relationship with Renee was really kind of interesting and not something you see typically in film, kind of that male-female buddy relationship without the love interest. Yeah. So it was interesting because I fully thought it was going to head like full out in that direction at some point, you know, and I was very pleased to see that it didn't.
Yeah. And some shout outs to some friends of ours like Caleb Ross and Stephen Graham Jones. He did mention Brett Easton Ellis and a couple other people as well randomly through with some printed materials.
Brett Easton Ellis is no friend of ours, sir.
Yeah, didn't I mention him kind of separately?
Yeah, you did. I just wanted to throw that in there.
He's not like an enemy, though.
No, he's not. We just haven't given him a chance to be our friend yet. Right. Yet.
So, it's you want to tell everybody how to get their slap their eyes onto this fine film?
So, in true Pablo D'Astaire fashion, this is available for free. You can go to apublicransom.wordpress.com. There's a link there, and you will be able to also obtain the password from that page to view it in Vimeo. Rob, we've had some experience with low budget filmmaking. What do you think? I mean, all in all.
Thumbs up. I liked it.
I liked it too. And I think that if anything, D'Estaire was able to prove kind of like proof of concept that he could write it and deliver it. And I don't know. I think we might see some bigger and better things coming from this guy if he decides to continue pursuing the film biz.
For sure. And oh, quick note, the accompanying music I liked pretty much the entire way through. It was very nice.
Yeah. The music provided by the Detroit Cobras, Belfleur, 100-100, and Goodloe Byron himself, Bryant, kidnapping fuck.
Kid killer.
Yeah, exactly. all right. That's just about going to wrap it up for this episode of Booked. Next week, do you have the phone number handy?
It's 773-599-1057.
All right. That's the phone number you're going to want to call to wish us. You've got a couple things you can do. You can call and wish us a happy 200th episode. You can call us and wish us a happy third birthday since they happen to happen on the same day, which is the day we'll be posting the next episode on April 1st. You can call just to say hey, or as some people have done, you could call and just ramble for 18 minutes and then we'll think about maybe putting it on the show or not.
One quick note before you sign us off. Our kickoff date for our birthday, April 1st, same birthday as Apple.
Oh, well, there you go.
So we just got to figure out who the Steve Jobs is in this equation.
Yeah. Well, we need is help from you guys. Send us some stuff because, you know what? We have nothing planned for next week. It's a week away. We have this big 200th episode that's going to be me and Rob going like, so what are you up to? Any TV shows you like? So give us something to work with and we'll try to run it on the show.
That's right. Until the 200th episode, I'm Rob Olson.
And I'm Livia Snudden. Keep reading.